right, hello and welcome everyone to the Football Scholars Forum, first one of 2021, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Heather Dichter, who is an associate professor at De Montfort University in Leicester and a member of the International Center for Sports History and Culture, and the editor of the book we're going to be discussing today entitled Soccer Diplomacy, International Relations and Football Since 1914, published by the University Press of Kentucky in 2020. And I'm also happy to report that Heather's forthcoming book with the University of Massachusetts Press is going to come out soon again, is entitled Bidding for the 1968 Olympic Games, International Sports Cold War Battle with NATO. So welcome, Heather. And as is tradition here at FSF, we will pass the ball over to you for a few minutes of introductory comments. And then if you could all raise your, not all, but you may raise your virtual hand to enter the queue, and our first round of questions of about four questions will then follow Heather's comments. So without further ado, welcome everyone. And thank you, Heather, for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me. And I really appreciate this invitation to speak to the Football Scholars Forum. And I know that a lot of the people here really do focus primarily on soccer, football, whatever you want to call the game, as your kind of primary sport that you study. And I guess for me, my primary sport, if you will, is the Olympic Games, or really kind of, I just look at international sport in general. And, you know, for me, it's about what sports and events were impacted by the different politics and issues that I've been looking at. And so, you know, that means that's led me to write on fencing and modern pentathlon and track and field, you know, gymnastics, ice hockey. But then, yes, obviously soccer, because it is the most popular game in the world. And so it does get affected by the different politics and issues in my own research. So I guess, you know, what that ends up meaning is I never thought I'd edit an entire book on the single sport of soccer, but I have now. And I'm really excited to finally see this book in print. And I'm so happy with how it's turned out. You know, this book kind of came about in a slightly odd way, or the not necessarily as, you know, standard way, considering that I didn't set out to write a book or edit a book on soccer. It was in talking with an editor at a press about a completely different project. And in that conversation, he was like, you know, I think actually a book on soccer and diplomacy, you know, to have that real focus, you know, narrower focus, because, you know, I had already edited Diplomatic Games, and there's been a number of other books either that were coming out then or have come out, edited books on sport and diplomacy more broadly that, you know, really do have a huge variety of sports that are included in it. But to have this real kind of more narrower focus on soccer and diplomacy, was a really great idea, and also one that would be doable because there's so much that people are writing on this one sport and diplomacy. And so kind of following that conversation, I started reaching out to scholars. Some were people who I had heard them present at a conference, and, you know, saying like, hey, have you published that, or do you have plans to publish that? Would you want to publish in this book? Reaching out to other scholars that I knew were working on this. And then, you know, really wanting to make sure there was as much of a geographical breadth as possible in the book, you know, thinking about what countries or regions didn't really, you know, I didn't have in the book already, and seeing who had written things, and, you know, that sense of like cold emails to people like, hi, I like your work. Do you want to be in this book? And so that's kind of how this book came about. And one of the things that initial editor had said was they thought that this book could appeal not only to sport historians, but also to diplomatic historians as a whole. And it was his idea about having kind of that second introductory chapter, if you will. If you think about Sarah Snyder's chapter, you know, she is an amazing scholar, an amazing diplomatic historian. I think her two books have each won multiple awards, you know, and for her to come in and be somebody who doesn't work on sport history, but to say, you know, that sense of kind of calling out to the rest of the non-sport scholars that, you know, this is really important work and that this work really does speak to a significantly broad audience. And so she was on board for that. And then, you know, asking Peter back to write a conclusion. You know, I think edited books are one of those where sometimes they just end and sometimes it's okay, but sometimes it's a bit unsatisfying. And to have Peter Beck, who, you know, he really hasn't done much with sport history since writing Scoring for Britain. And for him to come back to this topic, you know, really 15 years later after that book, because it's basically about when I feel like this book started, it had been about 15, 16 years for him. He was really excited to do it, to read everything that had been coming out in the field, to read all the chapters in the book. And he was excited to write this conclusion. And so that was, you know, I guess exciting for me to have him say yes and to have him be a part of this book. And you know, and he was really great, always wanting like the most recent version of every chapter, wanting to make sure, you know, what he wrote, Sarah wrote, and what I wrote were all, you know, aligned with each other, but right, saying different things. So it was great working with everyone and having him come and write this conclusion was just super exciting. So you know, I think for this, you know, thinking about the geographic spread, that was really the only kind of main idea in putting the chapters together, was this sense of like covering enough of the world, you know, in the sense that it was like, well, everything's on soccer and diplomacy, so kind of write what you want-ish a bit. And it really did come together, you know, and looking at all the chapters, kind of once they were all pretty much done, is almost all of the chapters deal with international tournaments. And I think that is, you know, is in some ways not surprising, but it also speaks to, you know, how important those tournaments are and at all levels. It's not just the Men's World Cup that matters to soccer diplomacy. But I think, you know, what came out of that as well, and I mentioned it at the end of the introduction, is, you know, that it was upsetting that there wasn't any chapters on, you know, the women's game, and particularly, you know, the Women's World Cup or women's soccer in general. You know, but I think at this point, the Women's World Cup is still so young. Any actual diplomatic files are going to be closed for quite a few decades still about those. But I think if we think about how the women's game, the Women's World Cup is, or the other continental tournaments, how they're kind of talked about, it's the sense of growing the women's game, which is great. But we don't hear hosting those tournaments being talked about the way as hosting the Men's World Cup, hosting the Olympic Games, hosting, you know, the Pan American Games, where it's more, you know, at more of those public diplomacy kind of reasons. So maybe I'm wrong, and maybe there's a document hidden in an archive somewhere that somebody will find in a couple decades and prove me wrong, which would be great. Or perhaps soon we'll start to see that change in that rhetoric. And, you know, if anyone, you know, wants to start off that book or that article with me saying this and now finally proving me wrong on that, like, that will be awesome. You know, but it was a shame that there just wasn't anything with women's soccer and diplomacy in the book, but I hope that there will be, you know, opportunities for people to write about that. And I guess, you know, this book, I hope, will kind of be an inspiration or a jumping off point for a lot of other future research. You know, I really like that this book, it's not just the soccer powers and it's not just the diplomatic powers, but really shows that all sorts of countries, no matter how good the rest of the world thinks that country is at the game or how powerful that country is in traditional diplomacy, but pretty much the whole world is using soccer diplomacy or using soccer as diplomacy. And so I really hope that there'll be a lot more research that follows from this, particularly, I think, looking at kind of the regional competitions and regional diplomatic relationships. I think that's really an opportunity for where future research can go and hopefully follow up from this book.
Super, thank you. We've got two folks in the queue already, so let's start with them. You're all welcome to join the queue. Chris Boltzmann will go first and Andrew Lee second. So over to you, Chris. And if you could just say where you're calling in from, that would be wonderful. Thank you.
Hi, Peter. I'm calling in from Los Angeles, although Cape Town is behind me where I'd prefer to be right now, but that's sometime in the future. Hey, Heather. Thanks very much for that. As somebody who contributed to the chapter, I really enjoyed writing for this collection and particularly enjoyed your editorial assistance and skills. My question is, as you said, this is the first sort of foray for you into football. How does sports diplomacy and football differ from the other sports you were engaged in? As you did mention, football being the most popular sport in the world, is there a difference, and can you maybe expand a little on that if you think there is one at all? I'll stop. Thanks.
Okay. It was great working with everyone in this book, honestly. And I will say, we got page proofs as like the world locked down it was like the end of March. And so, that was also a really awkward thing. Like, hi, the world is absolutely crazy. Can you please go over these page proofs? So it was really great that, you know, all the contributors still did that. I think when it comes to the soccer side with kind of, you know, my chapter in this book is kind of part of that bigger project that my monograph will be on. I think in the end with, East Germany on the whole not being so great and West Germany being so much better and, you know, those competitions, but then kind of just being Germany for the Olympics. Soccer was kind of not one of the most problematic sports when it comes to that project. If I think back to my doctoral research, I would say soccer was the most important from a public standpoint, not necessarily the most important to the occupation powers in Germany. I looked at how the Western Allies used sport to rebuild and democratize Germany after the war. And there were lots of sports that the Allies were concerned with, some of which they were more concerned with banning them for the Germans to participate in. But then they also saw the real benefits of soccer and having democratically organized clubs. And so I think soccer can do some of the same things that other sports does, but then can also be in a different situation either because it is so popular in that respect, or, you know, in the end, if the soccer tournaments that ended up being affected by politics were in some ways really minor, then it didn't get the notoriety that, for instance, world championships in ice hockey or alpine skiing might have had, based on, you know, the time of year and the sports and just the fact that it was a world championship. So it was far more noticeable than a UEFA youth tournament kind of thing.
Great. Thank you. Andrew Lee.
Hi. So I'm calling whatever we call this from New Jersey. So, I haven't read the book yet, but I have a question based on what you said about women's soccer also. So just a second, let me turn off the phone. So I'm wondering about FIFA and its organization as a diplomatic agent internally. And that the ban that FIFA put on women wearing headscarves in games, and the internal negotiations between different national soccer associations with FIFA to undo that ban that really required representatives from the region and pointing out to FIFA that it could be seen as a sort of a Eurocentric cultural decision. And I used to be a US youth soccer referee, and I used to have to explain to young women wearing headscarves, it's okay to wear the headscarf, but you need to tuck it in. It can't be flapping about, et cetera. And, you know, and that was always sort of an interesting negotiation because, you know, FIFA had banned it. And I really wanted to, you know, let these women wear their headscarves, but also keep them from like popping someone in the eye with it flapping around. So I was wondering, you know, isn't this possibly a case of women's soccer being used to negotiate relationships, or, you know?
I think that's a great example. And, you know, I think, that would be a great chapter, a great article from somebody who could definitely get access to, you know, those FIFA minutes, those, you know, they're probably not really so much letters these days. I'm so used to older documents, which are, you know, pre-email and stuff. But I think that would be fascinating, particularly knowing which individuals, which countries, you know, and how they push for it and the mechanisms of that change. And I think, you know, I mean, I know we kind of have news stories about that, but yeah, I think that would be a great piece of research for somebody. And I think Chris has put an article into the chat, so we should all read that.
Thanks for the link, Chris. All right, so John Dart, you can go next, and then I'll close out the first round. John, over to you. Where are you?
Hi, thank you. I'm calling from Leeds in the north of England. I'm halfway through the book, Heather, and I'm really enjoying the chapters. I think they've been beautifully written. My question is why were you attracted to preparing a book as opposed to a special issue journal? I know it's a reheated debate, but why a book rather than a special issue?
I guess because this just came about in a conversation with an editor at a press. But I think as well with the length of it, the number of chapters, this is beyond even really a double issue of a special issue of a journal. But I guess I never thought of it as a journal special issue because it came out of that conversation with an editor at a press. And you know, that not surprisingly, I think like almost every edited book, it took longer than any of us thought it was going to take. In the end, I am really happy it is as a book. And you know, kind of has this whole all of it coming together and has the really awesome cover that you know, the Icelandic Football Federation was kind enough to give us permission to use, because I think it even though it's obviously just from a single game between an American team and the Icelandic team, you know, really represents so much of what's in the book.
Thank you.
So I have both a comment and a question for you, Heather. The idea of soft power obviously permeates this collection, and we can maybe get into this more deeply later. But it seems to me that most of the contributions draw quite nicely on government archives of various kinds, and also, for lack of a better expression, the mainstream press. And I wonder if the contributors as a whole, maybe even certain ones individually more than others, kind of exaggerate almost the power of the state and of the political or business establishment vis-a-vis sort of non-institutional actors and non-state actors and even the subalterns. Because it seems to me that, you know, they also can affect and do affect soccer diplomacy. And I wonder if this in part is a problem of sources, right? So would oral history, for instance, or a variety of audiovisual sources be a productive way to complement the perspectives and voices and agency that we see documented here?
So that's a good question. I think one of the elements that I am really excited about that so many of the chapters do use is that combination of government documents, as well as the sport organization documents. Obviously there's challenges with getting them on both sides, with both sport organizations and the government. But I think it is that combination of bringing those together. The media, the newspapers can have those quotes where we might not be able to get the oral histories anymore. But that I think that when you do have all of those coming together, you're able to get a more balanced view. I think that's something that I actually found with my doctoral research, especially on the soccer side of things, that if I would have only ever used the US occupation powers documents about how they use soccer, like they completely attribute German soccer being awesome by the end of the 40s to the American occupation troops. Like, let's be honest here, it's not the Americans who were helping the Germans with their soccer. They actually hired a British coach to basically run all the soccer stuff in the American zone anyway. So, if I would have only used the American records, it would have been a very odd story. But when I had the, German soccer files and the FIFA soccer files combined to it, that's when the full story really came to light. And there was a lot more German agency in that story. Obviously, that's not this book. That's my other research. But I think that that use of drawing on multiple sources that a lot of the chapters do use helps prevent that kind of overemphasis on one side versus the other, perhaps. But, yes, oral histories would be great. I'm not sure how much Jack Warner would have wanted to sit down for an oral history, for instance, for that chapter. But maybe he would. Who knows? But so I think that, I think the more sources that we can have access to, the more voices and views that we'll get. And it might be that, for some of the more recent events that, hopefully we will be able to have some oral histories that will kind of have to be what holds us until, official foreign ministry files will be declassified in 2050 something, if we're lucky, for some of the countries.
Thank you. Brenda, kick off round two with the first question, also another contributor to the volume.
Yeah, definitely probably one of the worst, latest contributors and most difficult. So thank you for your patience, Heather. No, when the lockdown happened, I was a mess. But I guess on the one comment about gender, but it leads to a question, is to my mind, one of the very hallmarks of soccer is that as it became a kind of national identity par excellence for some of these countries, women were really pushed out of that representational space, right? So it becomes difficult because they're not cast as being worthy of being diplomats at all, right? So it gets really tricky if you're trying to do a volume like this and include women. I mean, my own book can deal with their own connections across borders, but mobilizing them for diplomacy, whether it's FIFA underdeveloping them or the Federation simply excluding them, I think that's really hard. In the next edition, it'd be interesting to just maybe throw that in the introduction, actually. But my question is about, so you have, historians more generally working on, and I think soccer scholars too, working on the issues of identity like race and gender. And you have this field of IR that for many of us looks very conservative in terms of how it approaches questions of identity. It's changed a lot, But when I was in graduate school, certainly it seemed like that was a place where they would not expand definitions of politics. So I just wanted to ask you if you felt that tension writing the book between some of these contributions that clearly are super engaged with those questions and the larger field of diplomatic history or international relations.
So I agree with all of your points on the gender side, and you know, second edition be great, or you know, hopefully there will be some change. And you know, I feel like you'll be the person that's editing that book on women, soccer, and diplomacy. I actually have to say that when I started attending SHAFER, the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations, I felt a lot of support for my research as a PhD student, and in fact, kind of everything since then, that I think that the field is, yes, there are still some more conservative thinkers in the field, but I think as a whole, diplomatic history has really expanded and grown and really recognizes the value of all sorts of other diplomacy and whatever it might be. You know, human rights, you know, sports, soccer, whatever the case may be. And so I think that there's a lot of support for it. And this book is in the University of Kentucky's diplomacy series. And my co-edited book, Diplomatic Games, was also in that series. Kentucky was very happy. You know, Diplomatic Games was their first sport book. I think if you want to exclude anything about the University of Kentucky's own basketball team or horse racing. But outside of those, you know, very, very Kentucky focused topics, Diplomatic Games was, you know, their first sport history, you know, it's kind of sport anything. And they've been really happy with it. It came out in paperback pretty much the same day Soccer Diplomacy came out. And it's being translated into Chinese, which is awesome. I can't wait to have my hands on it to look at it, I guess. And so I think, you know, they were really excited to publish Soccer Diplomacy as well. And I think that kind of speaks to the broader field of diplomatic history, international relations scholars looking, you know, a bit more on the political science side of things, but you know, looking at these topics and being more interested in it. And I think that's where Sarah Snyder's chapter kind of comes in to kind of try to pull in some of those more conservative thinkers to really try to call out to them, you know, you should pay attention to these ideas, these issues. And I think, you know, that was also one of the things that when I was kind of looking at all the chapters, once they were all, you know, done and in and you know, thinking about, you know, the introduction that I wrote was that every, you know, like all the major things, issues and events of the 20th century, they're all in this book, you know, fascism, the Cold War, the Vietnam War, apartheid, the rise of BRICS, corruption, you know, like those are all different chapters in this book. And, you know, those are kind of some of the big things that, you know, anyone teaching the 20th century in kind of whatever country is going to talk about some of these things. And so I think that also really speaks to the fact of how important studying sport diplomacy and, you know, obviously soccer, because every country's playing it and everyone's watching it.
Thank you. Nobody's in the queue, but there is a bit of a chat going on. So I'm not sure what the best way to proceed is, unless somebody wants to chime in who hasn't had the opportunity to do so yet, or maybe would like to follow up. I asked the cheeky question of what's the difference between diplomatic history and the history of IR, and then Andrew was talking about the difference between IR and diplomatic history, and so we were going back and forth about that. But anyone else want to throw something out? Or maybe get specific about particular chapters. We have three, if I counted correctly, at least three of the contributors themselves. So we could get into the specifics about Chile, about South Africa, about East Germany and West Germany. I mean, I know I grew up with strange things. Now, growing up in Italy, the way I learned my geography was through soccer. And the way I learned about other cultures was through soccer at the age of whatever it was, 5, 6, 7. So Sparwasser, like, is imprinted in my brain. It's probably why I don't make much sense a lot of the time. But, you know, your chapter on that very, very famous match, well, that included discussion of that famous match, brought that memory back when East Germany defeated West Germany in a tournament that eventually West Germany won, thanks to a somewhat dubious refereeing decision in the final, if you listen to the Dutch. Or maybe it was just their overconfidence in taking on the West Germans in that final. But while I was blabbering, I was trying to buy some time for our timid participants here. I did get a couple of additional questions. So I will give a heel pass to the best midfielder in the group, Andrew Guest, and then John Dart will have a chance for a follow-up. So over to you, Andrew. And again, please tell everyone where you're calling in from. It gives a nice global flavor to the conversation. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And the best midfielder in the group, I'd like to put that to the test. I think that would be an interesting claim. I'm skeptical. But yeah, I'm calling in from Portland, Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest. And I appreciate the project, because I was kind of looking through the book and reading different parts. I do some research about sports and development kind of in a grassroots development sense. And one of the things that strikes me about that, and I'm kind of curious if you see overlaps with, it's in some senses sports and diplomacy, but soccer more broadly, but soccer specifically, I think there is a tendency to kind of romanticize the influence that sport can have, and soccer in particular, the sort of the global game, the universal language and all that. And my sense in the sports and development world is that sometimes that is actually quite problematic, because you get this sort of evangelical zeal, people who really just love sports and love soccer and see it, you know, they see kids playing soccer on the dirt roads of African villages, and they say, this is the way to save the poor children, which of course is absurd and actually quite problematic. And I guess I'm kind of curious if there is a similar sort of evangelical zeal in the soccer and diplomacy world, particularly, you know, there's some people in the sports and development world that argue that it actually comes from some of the sport ethic, right? This idea that if you just have a single-minded devotion to a cause, you can achieve anything, which is actually kind of useful in if you're an athlete, but really problematic if you're trying to do something more nuanced, like development work or potentially diplomacy. And I guess since Peter mentioned some of the specific chapters, I mean, I was particularly interested in Chris's chapter about South Africa, where he's arguing for sort of failed sport diplomacy, right? This investment in soccer as the way to you know, ingratiate apartheid South Africa in the international community, and it doesn't really work. And so, you know, is there that sort of tendency to overinvest? Do you see that same evangelical zeal that I think is often problematic in the sports and development world?
So I think is a roundabout way of answering your question. You know, what I can't wait for someone to write, which I fear may not be for quite some time from an access standpoint, is, you know, there is an entire small department, you know, about sport diplomacy within the State Department, you know, and some other foreign ministries also have specific programs for that, and kind of a history of that department within, or, you know, sub-department within the State Department. You know, I think really getting access to their files and knowing, you know, how they're really talking about it and how they're seeing these kind of programs being used. And, you know, and obviously an oral history can be done and might have to be the way of kind of getting around that, because it's going to be quite some time till those files will be, you know, declassified, well, you know, declassified and available. But I think the specific programming that has now been around for about the last 10 or 15 years in some countries, I think that's going to be important because that's where there's clear specific, you know, the foreign ministry, the State Department, whatever it's called in each country, you know, actually saying we are specifically using sport. Unlike, you know, all the different chapters in this book where it's, you know, yes, some diplomats are writing about it, but it's that's not their primary job, is to focus on sport. And so I don't know what those documents and those individuals will say. Maybe it won't be quite so romanticized. Maybe it will be. I don't know. Yeah, there's still, you know, Sport for Development and Peace is so recent, still so growing, and, you know, is, and I think that's an area that has often, or has been treated in its first, you know, 10, 15 years by scholars outside of history. And now we're starting to see some historians write on that. And so perhaps the rhetoric around it, or the ways that it will be treated or viewed, written about will change a bit. I don't have a great answer for that. But what I did like that you brought up as well is Chris's concept of failed sport diplomacy, failed soccer diplomacy, which I thought was just absolutely a great new concept, because, you know, in sport diplomacy, we're almost always trying to talk about, you know, like what countries want to happen, you know, and hopefully achieving it. You know, the whole idea of public diplomacy is that. And here Chris has written a chapter about this failed diplomacy, failed sport diplomacy. So I'm happy to have Chris chat a bit more about that. But I thought it was a great concept, and I can see many of the chapters in the book being assigned in lots of different classes. But I can also see that chapter as a contrast to so much that has been written about South Africa and sport. But here's this, now this idea of this failed sport diplomacy. So feel free to chime in, Chris.
As Chris ponders chiming in, we'll hold on for a moment there and throw it over back to John in Bielsa country.
Thanks. Just a quick question. I was going to pick up on what Andrew says. I was quite surprised that Sport for Development didn't feature much more. I was just checking my notes, and the US Peace Corps mentioned only once in the introduction. And I thought there would have been more, but then you kind of explained that because it's so recent, that history isn't there. The other thing is, I know there's only so many chapters you can get in, but I thought CONIFA would have been mentioned a little bit more, because they're kind of like a key segment, or however you want to describe it, in terms of the smaller states and how they use it. Was it because you couldn't find anyone to write it, or because you made a tough editorial call on?
I think that's just more of one of those finding people to write, you know. There wasn't any, you know, specific, like, I really think we need to have a chapter on a specific topic within. I mean, although I was trying to see if I could find something on the women's game. But otherwise, you know, it was kind of more thinking about a geographical spread for the book. And so the regional federations kind of, not surprisingly, came out, you know, reappeared so many times, but there wasn't an initial goal of thinking, you know, we must include, you know, the book needs to include all the different kind of regional type of federations. So, you know, I think it was just kind of a sense of who I found writing on soccer and diplomacy, and as long as we didn't already have a country in the book on that, and you know, who was able to. So I think there's always going to be you know, topics, you're right, that you can't fit into a book, you know, and I think Latin America is probably one of those, like, I mean, it's like you almost want a chapter on every Latin American country or every European country, but then, you know, those are each a book in and of themselves. And so, you know, it was kind of a, I don't want to say a first come, first serve being in the book, but there's Yeah, it's tough making those decisions, but I think this was more of a finding people and running with it. So,
thank you.
Andrew's put an interesting comment in the chat. Andrew, do you mind if I read it out?
Yeah, please. I just was trying not to distract, but when Heather brought up.
Oh, that's fine. This is how it works. This is why it's an intellectual pickup game. It's not a conference. It's not a webinar. It's we are the only ones who do this. So
yeah. Just knowing when Heather noted the small State Department program, I just was mentioning that was something that struck me when I was reading the book too, is that's an interesting spot for the women's side, just because my sense is that without having done any systematic looking at it, that they a lot of their programs claim to be doing girls and women empowerment. And again, I actually think that is a space where sport can have an interesting impact. And so I think there's some really interesting possibilities there, but I also think it's often more nuanced than it's presented. And then, so that brings back that question of like, does the evangelical zeal help or does it hurt the cause in some of the ways that it's played out? But that's, as you said, Heather, probably a future project when people look back at what's actually.
It is. And that's one where that challenge of, okay, we could probably get oral histories now, but those might really emphasize those kind of positive, rose-tinted views on it. And, that's where that, longer view of time, seeing how things played out, seeing what the actual documents, the rationale behind things said, seeing if, maybe 20 years from now, girls and, who participated in and some of those programs will help run their countries and completely speak to being participants in those, in which case then, yes, talking about them as a success would be awesome. But yeah.
If I may, just to respond to some of the comments around failed sports diplomacy. I think particularly in the case of apartheid South Africa and the sports boycott and the struggle against apartheid in the sporting realm, there's very often this tendency to, I think, romanticize it and over celebrate it and suggest that there was no pushback or no resistance, particularly on the part of the apartheid regime, but also the role of white sports organizations. And in my chapter was looking at the Football Association of South Africa, essentially a whites-only football body. And in that, they were in no way diplomatic. And why I say that, they were not thinking of high politics, diplomacy. In many ways, some of these characters were quite crass and openly racist and seriously problematic. But I think they were used by the South African state, particularly the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to paint this or project this veneer of substantive change. And substantive change for the apartheid regime was having black and white players playing together. So on the one hand, yes, that was the case. And you have these documents that the South African government printed for FIFA delegations showing black and white players playing together. But what they failed to see is that the constitution of the association still barred black and white kids playing football together in schools. So I think this idea of, particularly in the South African case, looking at resistance to change is something which I found very fruitful in my own research. And that goes back to, I think, what Peter had mentioned earlier around some of the resources and sources. And I was fortunate enough to come across a large archive, which is available at Fitz University, so anybody can access it, of the formerly whites-only football association. And that was, I think, very, very fruitful and has been fruitful in my own research over the years. But again, goes back to sources, which can, of course, be problematic very often. I'll stop.
Chris is being modest here. He was instrumental in getting that set of documents into the Wits library and manuscripts and archives there for us to be able to consult. Yeah, I was thinking as you were speaking and also listening to Heather, the sort of kind of white networks of power in soccer diplomacy would be interesting to investigate further as well. I mean, the South Africans were obviously at the heart of it, but important cogs in the machine were Americans during the Cold War. Maguire is an official who was clearly sympathetic to white South Africans, and one may even argue didn't have too many problems with the apartheid regime. Stanley Rouse, of course, as the president of FIFA from 1961 to 1974. And there were others. You know, it wasn't just Washington, London, Pretoria, the usual triangle. There were other forces also that worked actively through diplomatic channels to undermine the sort of Bandung spirit of the football world and its allies. So that would be interesting to get into a little bit more, you know, sort of, I don't know, alternative forms of diplomacy, diplomacies of opposition, of resistance, who really muddle up the goals of the West, and also, you know, lay bare sometimes the purely propagandistic nature of some of these enterprises. I think the chapter on Real Madrid and Franco was quite illustrative in that sense. But I'll be quiet here.
Well, if I can, if I can just, you know, respond to that, I think, yeah, there's so much more, you know, and that's what I'm excited for is for scholars to research into the other countries, you know, the ones we don't think of as the diplomatic powers or, you know, again, also the kind of European soccer powers or the countries where kind of a lot of those leaders that you just mentioned came from, you know, and countries which do have, you know, significant non-white populations and those relationships between those countries and how they're working with each other, against each other. And that's what I look forward to so much more, so that, you know, the person who does the, you know, if it is me or whatever, the next version of soccer diplomacy really struggles on, you know, what do you include? And the book is twice as large as this one, you know, and so that's what, you know, I think, yeah, there's so much. I don't know what it is. I haven't seen those files, but, you know, I hope we start to see a lot more of that research.
Thank you. Stefan.
Hi, Peter. Hi, Heather. So I'm just down the road here from Peter, just a little bit further south of the Arctic. This is such a really fascinating subject. And I think one of the things that I find, you know, just incredibly gripping about this is the way in which from its very beginning, soccer presented itself as apolitical. And that thread of being apolitical has sort of, you can follow the evolution of the game, you know, entirely through that idea. And still to this day, people say, oh, sport and politics, they don't mix. And yet, you know, apart from global diplomacy and global GDP, what is there that is global other than soccer in some ways? So, you know, my question is this: we see the interaction of diplomats, governments, and sporting authorities all the time, and sometimes they work together and sometimes they're in opposition. So, you know, I suppose my question is, when do you think, what are the conditions necessary for soccer and the government to work, you know, for this cooperation to go with the grain? And when does it go against the grain? How should we think about that, that intersection?
Wow. I mean, I think quite frankly, all of the, I think it always does go together, you know, the soccer and politics, sport and politics, but, you know, especially in this book, soccer and politics, they always are together. They always are so linked. And I think, you know, this book shows that it's so many different types of political regimes were doing this. And I think what I really liked about the chapters on France and Spain is showing that this is not a post 1945 thing either. You know, it's a lot more common after 1945, but you know, we saw this before 1945 with two very different types of political systems, you know, democracy and Franco Spain. So, you know, I think in seeing that it kind of is always going to be linked. And so I think that's my view.
Sorry, if I could just clarify, that wasn't quite what I was getting at, in the sense that, I mean, yes, I think I'm sure everyone in this room agrees that sport is political. The idea that it's not political is somehow absurd. So it's not, so that it's not that I'm not questioning about whether it is ever political. I'm just thinking, so give you an example, Olympic research. Obama thought he was going to get the 2016 Olympics with good reason. And I think, that was a case of, and you would have thought that would have, was a slam dunk, but it turns out it wasn't. So in some sense, the politics of the United States went against the grain of the IOC, and that's what led to that failure in some sense. Whereas, you know, the US got the Trump got the 2026 World Cup, which is bizarrely went with the grain of FIFA in this particular case. So I'm just thinking about when do they match up, and when do they fail to match up, and how should we think about that
process? Well, I think there's also, you know, in those kind of votes for who gets to host, you know, it's not just the politics, but then there's also the internal, you know, it's not just the diplomacy or the country's kind of there where they're going politically. There were a couple of reasons that factored into why Chicago got so few votes, and part of the struggles were between the IOC and the USOC, you know, and about how much money the US got from the top marketing. The percentage, the US has always received more money than any other country. And so I think, you know, those kind of internal to sport issues also had a bearing on how the votes went as well. I don't think you can predict, I guess, this, you know, from your two examples, you can't predict when it's going to go one way and not go another way. But I also think that in looking at, and this is something I do in my book that'll be out later this year, is, you know, we've often just looked at who won, or we've looked at why a single city didn't win or a single country didn't win. But actually looking at all the candidates together and really tells a more complete picture in a way, you know, that there's kind of pushes and pulls on each country and how those factor against each other and playing off of, you know, some countries kind of playing off each other. And you know, and then there's always your block voting or that sense of, you know, part of why Vancouver Whistler won in 2010 was because over a much stronger Austrian bid for the Winter Games was because all of the major European, Europe wanted the Summer Games in 2012. And they knew if the Winter Games in 2010 were in Europe, that was going to diminish London, Paris, and Madrid's chances for 2012. So, you know, I think that sense of kind of looking at all of the countries or cities bidding for an event kind of helps into considering all those views, that it's not necessarily just that politics and the sport organization, you know, the politics of one country and a sport organization. There's a lot of elements that factor into those decisions.
Stefan, would you like to follow up?
Yeah, I mean, so in some sense, we don't live in a monocausal world, it's a multi-causal world. And I agree with that. And I think, I mean, what's interesting is if we can try to isolate things that are more important or less important, and I think it's very difficult to do that. But I think there's something in terms of this analysis of seeing where the politicians have reasonable expectations about what can be done and where they have unreasonable expectations. I mean, I think certainly if I think in terms of the UK and its sporting efforts, the UK it's become increasingly desperate in this world to try and project its alleged hegemony over the sport it claims to have invented. And it becomes actually making itself more and more isolated in the process, not actually succeeding by throwing itself around. It strikes me that sometimes this kind of diplomacy works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's just interesting to think about why when these things happen. But anyway, that's just
well, and there's also their giant miscalculations. You know, sometimes they're just like, yes, this is going to happen. And then everyone votes in a different way or, you know, something happens and it doesn't turn out that way, which is, when you're able to, you know, some of those examples as well, where you kind of see that playing out, or, you know how that vote's going, but here you have these documents when they're like, we have all of the votes, we're going to be selected, or that's not going to happen, you know, and then they're so wrong, and it backfires. Sometimes because, you know, and these are some of the examples I've seen, especially when it comes to Germany and the Cold War, is because the West German foreign ministry is actually taking such clear actions that it actually really upsets the sport leaders, the sport administrators. And so they vote against what West Germany wanted, because they were so, you know, the sport leaders were so appalled at the politicians, you know, sport and politics, they should be separate, at least in the sport leaders' mind. And so that kind of giant miscalculation. You know, so it's hard to say that there's ever going to be like, this is when it's going to go with the grain and this is when it'll go against. You know, you kind of have to look at each instance and look at all the elements to each instance and kind of how they all factor in to be able to see what went wrong, see what went right, all of that. Yeah.
Any questions from some of the folks who haven't had a chance to intervene yet? There are several of you on the call. If not, we've got Enrico. Okay, Enrico, you're more than welcome to ask a question to one of the contributors to the volume. Brenda, go for it, Enrico. Over to you, and please let us know where you're participating from. Thank you.
Hi, man. I'm calling in from Belgium, and I'm working on Ecuadorian national identity and football. And I was really interested in your concept of everyday diplomacy of civic associations. And I was wondering if it was typical of Chile, or did you encounter it in other Latin American countries too?
Hi, Enrico. Thank you for asking me, and thanks, Heather, for including me so I can answer. So because the structure of sports associations in professional football is distinctive in CONMEBOL, right, in South America, at least up until 10 years ago, those civic associations have a particular place in the politics and moral landscape of South America. Now, I haven't worked extensively on Ecuador, but certainly in the case of Brazil, Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, you know, I would make the argument that their status as nonprofits, right? So even though they're running professional football teams and they're incredibly profitable, the structure of them is still, you know, they still vote for the directors, they're still voting. And it's a nonprofit, mutually owned, right? If Flamengo collapses tomorrow, there's no owner, right? That's a really particular structure that is maintained in South America in that period. And it means that they're connected to politicians and to government organizations in particular ways. And that's why I think if you look at South American football, you really have to explode the idea of what counts as diplomatic history and who counts as a diplomatic actor, because it is really not a privatized enterprise in the same way. So I would guess, yes, in Ecuador, because certainly I find it in Alianza Lima in Peru. So I don't know why I wouldn't find the same thing in Ecuador, but I'm not good enough with Ecuadorian football to say for certain, but I'll be excited to follow your work.
Thanks. I've seen in the archives some interesting context between Ecuador and Colombia, like that Ecuador was using Colombia as a kind of spokesperson within the FIFA. So, but I have to explore that further.
Yeah, I mean, CONMEBOL in general is really tight regionally. You're talking only 10 teams. They play each other in the most competitive qualifiers for a world tournament that exists in football. Sorry, everybody else, but there's think about how few teams and how they're in such constant interaction. So I do think it's unique in terms and in the chapter. I try to talk about the importance of, so for a place like Chile, their relationship with Brazilian football and those diplomats is much more important most of the time than any European country. And that we, I think that's like a sometimes a misperception, right? But yeah, they're working for power within CONMEBOL more than they're necessarily looking for power within FIFA, particularly once Havelange in 1974 as president, then your jockeying of power within CONMEBOL means you can jockey for power with the very top of FIFA, maybe.
Thank you for your comment.
Yeah, stay in touch.
Yes, we certainly need more scholarship on Ecuador. One of the countries in South America that really has not been covered, at least in the English language scholarship. I'm not as familiar with the Spanish language scholarship. Maybe Brendan Arrigo can correct me on that. But
nope, needs more. You're right.
Yeah, when I was in Ecuador, I was trying to read up on Deportivo Quito and SC Barcelona and Guayaquil and didn't find much, which was somewhat disappointing because, again, my entry point to the history and culture of most places is through the beautiful game. I don't know if there are folks who'd like to intervene. I thought of something while reading, particularly the chapter on Real Madrid as kind of cultural ambassadors of Franco, but it came up in some of the other chapters as well. So I'm sort of doing those sideways midfield passes to buy time, you know, keep possession. And the thought was about the English Premier League as a diplomatic force, representing a variety of political and economic interests. Heather, do you think there's something to be said about the EPL's soft power in particularly areas of the global south? I would say certainly the African continent is a hotbed of EPL fandom, but also huge swaths of Asia. And so if we can make that argument that the EPL, you know, projects and uses soft power to advance its interests in those quote unquote markets, then how does that affect our understanding and our study of soccer and diplomacy?
Well, I guess I will complicate that kind of question by saying I'm not sure if it's so much the EPL as, you know, all of the teams together as a league, as almost like each individual team. And in some ways, it really matters who the owners are, you know, because, you know, for instance, here in Leicester, you know, Leicester City is owned by a Thai family. And, you know, because it's, you know, it's King Power Stadium, that King Power Company in Thailand is so huge that, you know, once that family bought Leicester City, Leicester City's presence, you know, expanded exponentially in Thailand and elsewhere, you know, and then also winning the Premier League helps. But, you know, I think, in some ways, I almost think it's more about who the owner is or where the owner is based and what other teams they then also purchase, because then Leicester City has a partner club in Belgium, and I don't know which one it is. I'm sure Enrico can mention, can come in and share which one it is. You know, and so that sense of having that relationship between Thailand and England and thanks Enrico for, oh, it's Leuven and Belgium, you know? And so I think those diplomatic ties are based more on the ownership. And so I think there's tons to go from there as well as future topics for, you know, volume two and volume three of Soccer Diplomacy.
Sense a series building here. And we did cover some of this terrain with David Goldblatt this past summer, northern summer, southern winter, when we did, in lieu of Euro 2020 during the pandemic, we had that marvelous, what, 5-6 week series with David. And he certainly brings it out quite beautifully and powerfully, this dimension of the story. Other thoughts, comments? It is, we're now on an hour and 10 minutes or so.
I got to ask another one if no one else is up for it. I don't want to take any precedent, but I'm just sort of curious at a more macro level, the idea of soccer and diplomacy in a academic context. I see, Heather, that you're a professor of sport history, but also sport management. And my sense is that, again, more familiar with sort of the sports sociology sort of side of things, but I do think a lot of sports sociology has been essentially co-opted by sport management. And so it's spun from a more kind of critical and, you know, inquiry-based endeavor to a more instrumental endeavor to try to figure out how to make money off sport. And I wonder if there's anything similar going on in sport and diplomacy, like do you, or soccer and diplomacy, right? Like, do you get students or people from FIFA trying to say, like, you know, I'm actually less interested in the intellectual endeavor and more interested in how to do this well. And is that, like, you know, is there a sort of evolving science of soccer diplomacy beyond the historical inquiry? And whether or not there is, I'm also kind of curious what you would say, like, what are best practices in soccer diplomacy after going through all these chapters and, you know, looking at it in all these different parts of the world, if we wanted to be instrumentalist about it?
Wow. Best practices. I feel like that's when you'd actually have to talk to the people working in that department at State Department for it. But actually, I think, you know, students in sport management, it's not something that they necessarily think about or recognize and talk about it. But I do think some of the students, depending on what countries they might come from, do have an interest in sport for development, or that it more so kind of back in their own country and recognizing that, you know, that they can, they want to make sport better. They want to help different populations in their own country. And so I think they can, even though they don't know the terminology for it, that when they can come across some of these examples, that it appealed to kind of, they then recognize it, kind of opens their eyes to it. What I will say is last year, before the pandemic and in those pre-times, for one day of the FIFA Masters here at De Montfort, we're one of the three universities for the CIS Masters. We actually did a whole day on sport and diplomacy. We kind of gave some case studies in the morning, and then we actually had them role play in the afternoon, and we gave them like a made up situation between countries having issues and a couple of, you know, they were in groups and one of them was also the International Federation. And we gave them time to like go prepare. We gave them, you know, a little bit of info sheet. And then we kind of came back together and they role played it. And it was amazing to watch and to have them really think and see how all of these relationships kind of play out. And then it turns out we learned in that period where they were all in their groups, there were some like back channel texting, trying to, not so much bribery, but trying cajoling and stuff. And so I guess they were really preparing for a future in working in sport.
Or working for FIFA, right?
So I think, you know, if there's opportunities in the classroom to kind of give them that chance of role playing after having done readings and recognizing some of, you know, some historical examples, I think they really do gain a lot from it. I mean, as they can in many of those kind of situations, you know, for whatever the history or event, you know, or other subjects too, But I think they then really recognize the challenges of trying to achieve what you want, but also still having to, you know, play nice with everyone. And still also, you know, and especially, I guess, from a sport management standpoint, still being able to have your event, you know, because when the diplomacy or politics goes bad and your event is disrupted, you know, that on the sport management side is then you don't have money, you don't have fans, you lose sponsors, whatever the case may be. And so having to think about that side of it as well.
Okay, we have a question from Chuck.
Hello, thank you very much. I have a question about, do you see any correlation between success on the field and success in diplomacy? So for example, I'm thinking of China, which obviously is a massive player in the world stage, but has not been particularly successful outside of Asia.
When you say success on the field, do you mean the men's game or the women's game? Because
excellent point. Even though, but again, Chinese women's soccer is decreasing as other South Korea, other Asian women teams are improving. So
yeah, well, I mean, and even and thinking about the U.S. as well, you know, like for. You know, which team is better? And how is the U.S.? Well, you know, then again, the U.S. can change in its influence in the world, depending on who might be in the White House. I think probably not. You know, I think if they're both successful at the same time, you know, it's kind of like a happy coincidence, most likely, more than anything, although, you know, some people may try to make some sort of correlation or you know causality, but I think probably more often than not, it's just it happens to be that way. In thinking about Germany, it's saying, you know, most people say that 54 was, you know, like this West Germany has returned to the international the international community, and I have to say so. When I was working on my PhD on the occupation and into the early years of the Federal Republic, you know, and everyone was like, oh, well, you're ending with 54, right? And I didn't. I ended in 52 with West Germany at the Winter Olympics in Oslo. But like every German Scot, every historian of Germany, you know, most of them don't work on sport, but we're like, well, obviously you'll end in 54. And I didn't. I actually saw Germany's return with being cheered, marching into the opening ceremony in a country that they had occupied during the war. But from like a public memory standpoint, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's 54. I think there's probably not so much that that correlation, but it is interesting to see. And I guess that's where, you know, the sense of soccer diplomacy is used regardless of how good one's country is on the pitch and how powerful one might be, you know, globally. And that's where I think, you know, the regional relationships, you know, as Brenda was mentioning, and where I think like, goodness, there's so much more. And we might see, you know, even different relationships and ideas that we don't recognize yet because no one's done that research yet. So.
Great, thank you. And thank you for pointing out the difference between men's and women's. I didn't think that through.
Class. Well, I often, when I teach over here I in England and I say soccer is a women's game, students' responses and faces tend to be a bit painful when I say that at times.
Thank you. Jermaine Scott, over to you.
Hello. Hi, Heather. Thank you so much for editing this text. I haven't had a chance to read it, but it's on the way. And as I was flipping through the pages, I saw how there was two chapters related to the African diaspora, specifically in the Caribbean and in South Africa. And I was really just wondering, and I know you mentioned it in your introduction, but I was wondering if, you know, how may a history of colonialism and empire change our understanding of soccer diplomacy itself, right? So is there a way to conceptualize soccer diplomacy as being constituted by these elements of coloniality and racism and things of that nature, thinking about the kind of global nature of the game, the global spread of the game through these colonial channels, and how the concept of diplomacy itself is, I guess, is really what I'm interested in, and how that may be in relationship with histories of colonialism.
I think there's so much opportunity in those areas, and that was where just a little bit that I wrote in the introduction about, there's a chapter on South Africa that Chris wrote, which is great, but there's a whole other rest of the continent, and there's so much more to be written, and I think, and that's where there's a chapter, not about soccer, but a chapter in my Diplomatic Games, my earlier edited book, about France and the Friendship Games, kind of the forerunner to the All Africa Games, because that started with France and its former colonies in Africa, the French speaking states. And so I think there's definitely more to be done in that area, and specifically on soccer. I had a colleague at Ithaca College who works on public health and infectious diseases. And when I was still there at Ithaca, and we were talking, and this was when the Ebola outbreak was, 6 years ago now. And she teaches public health. And in our conversation, she ended up developing it into an activity in the classroom and getting her public health students to think about the impact, the wider impact on society, because when they can't have soccer games because of public health, and then those it's there in the introduction and a few sentences, the fact that the Ebola crisis then became a problem of countries not wanting certain countries not wanting some of the West African teams to come to the continental tournament, and so there's tremendous amounts of kind of work to be done in that area, and whether or not it's with relation to former colonial powers, or it's life after colonial the empire no longer being a colonial state, subject state. So I think there's so much to be done, and I had wished there was at least a second chapter on, a different state in the entire continent of Africa, and hadn't found, be it the person working on it or not. So, I think there's so much, and I think it will really enhance our understanding of diplomacy and sport for sure.
Great. Thank you so much.
So if am I signing you up for that chapter in the second edition now?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. A whole book is due, actually. Thank you.
All right, we have time for a final question, or if it's brief, maybe two. Anyone want to have the final word? Or make a final comment, perhaps, rather than ask a question? Well, if not, Heather, maybe last word over to you then.
Okay, thanks. No, this has been such a great conversation this evening, and definitely, lots of ideas for the next couple editions of this book, apparently. And I guess that's where that comment earlier about I never thought I'd set out to edit a book entirely on soccer. And now apparently we're talking about multiple follow-up editions. And I think that really just shows how much out there is, that, and I think it just shows how needed a book on diplomacy and this one single sport, the most popular sport in the world, and how much opportunity there is for studying it from so many different perspectives and relationships and ways. And so I'm just excited to see so many people interested in the topics and their kind of routes into the area, or thinking about ideas for future research as well. And so I I thank you for letting me come to participate in the Football Scholars Forum to talk about soccer diplomacy.
Well, it's been a real pleasure, and I'd like to thank you again, Heather, for your time and for facilitating the discounted offer for your hardcover book. It really is important for us to get access to that these books be affordable. So I really appreciate your efforts on that front. And I want to end just by letting everyone know that our next session is scheduled for April 21st, also at 3 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, 8 p.m. London time. And it's going to be with David Truil, I think that's how you pronounce his last name. Apologies if I'm butchering it, David. And his brand new book with University of Chicago Press entitled Football in the Park, which is a kind of ethnography of West LA through the prism of park football. So I think a very interesting topic. It's available in a paperback and soft cover, so it is affordable. And I encourage you all to get the book. I'm reading it right now. And so there will be another FSF on April 21st, and hope you all join us for that one. Take care, everyone. Stay safe. And thanks, everyone, for participating.